Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Joining me today is the treasurer-elect. I was trying to figure out how to say that, Mike. Mike Pichak, who is Vermont's treasurer-elect, and he's come in to talk about being Vermont's treasurer in challenging times. I added that to my list here. You've really walked in on an interesting time, Mike. But
yeah,
congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And we'll see how challenging they are. I mean, the economic forecasts, I think, are a little cloudy still.
Right.
As we try to see what's happening with inflation, where the stock market's going, where underlying fundamentals of our economy is going. But I don't think anybody really knows.
No, they don't. As a matter of fact, we have a reporter from Washington, D.C. coming on later. And I was reading his notes, and he was saying the exact same things. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's not good, but who knows?
Yeah.
How bad is bad? But anyway, maybe you could – I'm sure people know you from COVID, from our data collector. I tell you, I kept saying to Bruce, where's Mike? I need – what's Mike got to say? Could you tell them a little bit about yourself and why you decided to run for treasurer?
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. So I grew up in Brattleboro. That's where where I grew up, where I lived, where I went to school. I went away to college, law school, came back to Vermont about 9 years ago, worked at the Department of Financial Regulation, 6 years as commissioner. But growing up in Brattleboro, my parents, one was a Democrat, my mom, my dad was a Republican. So
yay, mom.
So, when I was young, they used to be able to watch TV in the same room, and that's no longer the case. So that's a little disappointing. I think it's reflective of our politics more broadly, but they were not, involved in politics. They were interested in politics. They were much more interested in their community. My dad was the president of the Chamber of Commerce, was helping expand the golf course in Brattleboro to 18 holes, even though he didn't play golf, bring lights to the football field, bring a teen center to Brattleboro, those kind of community engagement activities. And my mom, very similarly, on a different bent, but she started a soup kitchen when she was pregnant with me 39 years ago and still runs it to this day.
Good for her.
So they both were very community engaged and community oriented, and that was very impactful on me. And I really, I asked my dad, why did you do so many of these things that took away from your professional time and your family? And he said that Brattleboro just gave us so much and gave him so much,
nice,
and our family so much, that it was the least that he could do to give back. And that was really impactful for me, trying to find ways to give back. And that's always been a primary ambition of mine in seeking public service.
That's great. Good for you. Good for your family. Great, great roots.
Yeah.
And Brattleboro is a great area anyway. It's a great community.
Yeah, I really enjoyed growing up in Brattleboro.
Yeah,
and
I bet.
I've mentioned this before, but just like any small town in Vermont, like, it instills certain values and ways of acting on you, because you see people in multiple instances. You see someone in school, and you see them in church,
right.
You see them on Main Street, you see them in the park. And it really forces you to get along with people in a way that, if you come from a big city, you don't necessarily have to do. Because you're going to see that person in another situation inevitably in the very near future, and you have to be able to get along with them.
The trick is to recognize them in different settings. I am so bad. Like, I know who you are, but if I saw you in Price Chopper, the mind just goes blank. I know that guy, but who is he? But anyway, when you were in financial regulations, and that department, by the way, has changed names more times over the years since I've been in state government than any other department.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it was in charge of health care, and it just went on and on for years.
It used to be called BSHCA.
BSHCA, right.
So the department formerly known as BSHCA, Banking, Insurance.
Exactly.
Healthcare Administration.
Exactly. It just went on. It kept changing. I'm like, oh, my. But I did remember BSHCA, but I like financial regulations. That's a better thing. Anyway, when you got there, I don't think folks realized the role you played in the EB-5, shall we say the word, scandal. You really kind of raised your hand and said hello.
Yeah.
Didn't you? Can you talk about that?
I don't know. Yeah, for sure.
I think all the lawsuits and stuff are over.
Yeah, no, happy to. You know, yeah. It was a challenging time, right? Because, you know, this program was thought to be, you know, something that was saving the Northeast Kingdom, and they were right. bringing jobs and doing a lot of great investment. So when you started to peel back the curtain on that and things weren't checking out, you know, that really put us in a conundrum because we had to figure out every single dollar that was spent over, mm-hmm. you know, basically a decade of a period that was a decade long, $450 million that had come in through investment, you know, hundreds of thousands of transactions, hundreds of bank accounts, you know, dozens and dozens of subpoenas, and piecing that all together in a very detailed and systematic way, you know, it took us about a year to do, but we were really proud of that because we were able to put it all together in about a year. The SEC had been working on it for years before we got involved. It took them the entire year that we worked on it to finish it. So they've finished it in about 3 years. The FBI, it took them about 4 years to get to bringing charges against them. We did it in about a year. So we really leaned into that and tried to figure out what was going on as quickly as we could.
That's great.
And we had suspicions. You know, the first meeting I had with them, there were a couple of questions that we had that we didn't get great answers to. And that's what started our digging was that first meeting. We said, well, wait, you said that you haven't talked to the SEC. And we called the SEC the next day, and they said they've been talking to you regularly. You know, you said that, you know, you'll get us these documents that we asked for in the meeting, and they never came.
Right.
You gave us an explanation in the meeting that then changed 2 weeks later. So there were things there that gave us reason to start digging in on that, and we just put our shoulder into it and made sure that we had a 100% accurate case against
That's
them before
great.
Filing.
Well, congrats on that, because I know from people within state government, they said Mike Pichak is right on top of this. But the program itself – I know Sugarbush has a great program,
yeah.
and I talked to them about that, and they said it was small enough that they could control it and manage it and watch it. But
yeah,
I think this
sure.
thing just got so out of
well,
control.
Well, Sugarbush did it. You know, Wynn Smith is a
yes,
great
Wynn,
owner,
right.
and he came from the financial world, and they put in a number of checks and balances, so, you know, you just really couldn't have a scenario that developed at JP.
Yeah,
they did it the right way.
Yeah, because I don't want people to think this is not a bad – the concept was good. It was just mishandled.
Yeah, exactly. And there are other programs in Vermont that worked well.
Yeah.
It really was a matter of the two principals, Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros, played different roles.
Right.
One was much more behind the scenes and took a lot more of the money. The other was much more front-facing and, you know, didn't necessarily benefit financially as significantly as Quiros. But they're both, you know, together they were able to pull this off.
Right. Wow. Well, I'll tell you, you know what my clue was? When Tony Palmisano went up to Newport and walked away from that deal, I said to myself, uh-oh, if Tony Palmisano said there's – and he said there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, there's a clue.
Yeah, he has good instincts. I mean, obviously from a long career in business.
For sure.
Yeah.
You can't put much by Tony Palmisano.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I've known him for years and just when he said something, you better pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely right.
So I think he was right on it. But anyway, thank you for that. And let's just talk a little bit about the modeling work you did for COVID. And then I want to get back to some of your accomplishments during your time at DFR. What got you – did they ask for this modeling? What? How did it all get – because you are good, may I just say.
Well, thank
and
you.
What's really great is I understood it. So that's my test of whether – how good you are.
Well, that was our test too. I mean, we knew it had to be digestible to everyone, not just to the media but to Vermonters because so many Vermonters were watching the press conferences directly. So we always wanted to speak as simply as we could, break the concepts down as clearly as we could, and just present what is a really complicated subject matter, you know, in the most easy fashion as possible. So I remember, you know, quite distinctly the time the governor asked a number of us to come up to his cabinet room. I think I was the only one that hadn't been working directly on COVID-19 up until that point. So when the governor came in and sat down, he said, well, Mike, you might be wondering why I asked you to be here today. And
uh-oh.
Yeah, it kind of was. I thought it had to do with health insurance and, you know, we were working on covering the tests for COVID and things of that nature. But he said, we want to take a look at how COVID is going to impact Vermont. We know it's impacting Northern Italy and China and impacting senior citizens and older people in those countries. So what does that mean for Vermont, the second oldest state in the country? will we have a disproportionately negative impact? And that was a great question to ask, and we went off and started to put together a team, both internally to the department and externally with infectious disease experts and really leading academic institutions to work with us and try to come up with some estimates around how many ventilators might we need, how many hospital beds might we need, how many emergency beds might we need, ICU beds might we need. And we just started to develop that. And first it was internally, and then it became external when we decided the media and Vermonters should sort of understand the work that we were doing as well. So then that started really a two-year period where every week at least we were presenting on what were the trends, not just in Vermont, because as we all came to know, we were really impacted by what was going on around us in the region, and the region was impacted by what was happening in other parts of the country, and the country was impacted by what was happening in other parts of the world.
Right.
So we really had to keep our eye on sort of everything to get a sense of how the trends were moving and what Vermont might see in the weeks and months to come at any given point.
Well, we thank you for that. I really do, because sometimes, as my family will tell you, I am clueless, and I really understood it, and which was very helpful because I am a member of the senior class of Vermont here. So I want to spend the last half hour of this hour talking about the treasurer's position, but you have made so many accomplishments during your time at DFR. I thought it was worthwhile to point them out, and you can let us know what the back story is. But there was a record $1.8 million settlement with a South Carolina insurance company. This, I love this, for selling unapproved and inadequate health insurance to college students. What a team.
Yeah, that one, we really were proud of that work. I mean, it took a long time to get to the bottom of it. But it turned out there were about 212 college students that were going to school in about a half dozen institutions in Vermont who were not getting the coverage that they were required. And it wasn't like it didn't have an impact. It was having an impact. These students were largely from lower socioeconomic households. They were from international students that didn't have coverage from their parents. And they were getting injuries, like one person had a sports injury.
Wow.
It was an $80,000, out-of-pocket cost that they had to repair their knee and whatever. And that was something that they paid out of their pocket until we came in and got full restitution for them after the fact.
Oh.
So we got full restitution for those 212 college students and then had $1 million penalty on top of that because we thought the behavior was so egregious that we wanted to set an example. And overall, it was the largest settlement that our insurance division has ever had.
Good for you. I'm impressed. Before we get into the treasurer's job, I wanted to just kind of go over what Mike had been doing for us at Financial Regulations and lots of accomplishments. I love this. You expanded the supervision of online security trading and cryptocurrency platforms. Well, there's a thing I know zippo about. I don't know how many people really get cryptocurrency.
Yeah, well, I don't know how many people get it that are working in that industry.
Oh, great.
Great. Yeah, no, it's really challenging. And we're seeing it play out right now. I mean, FTX, which is a really big crypto exchange, has been spinning around toward financial collapse in the last couple of days.
Oh, great.
There are a couple of others that had really significant financial challenges when some of the when the market got a little bit more volatile and some of their basically even the SEC and some of the state actions required them to provide more information and that was a real challenge for them. So at the bottom line, we want to support innovation every single time. We want to support new ideas, new companies. But this framework that's been established for decades and decades and decades around banking protections, securities protections to protect Vermonters and all Americans, it's really fundamental and important. We want to make sure that your hard-earned money is not going to go down the drain because somebody has a funny idea that sounds really sophisticated and really special, when really it's just a repackaged version of somebody trying to sell, tulips back in the whatever.
Great.
So that was a real important part of our oversight to make sure that they were following Vermont's laws and behaving well.
So FTX, is that – they must do business here in Vermont?
Yeah, they do business around the world.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
And you're thinking they're going to not make it?
Yeah, that's the – they're in very, very dire financial situation right now.
So even though – this is going to show you how – I don't know what I'm talking about. Cryptocurrency is currency, but not really currency. There's nothing to hold in your hand.
Yeah, it's not.
But it'll all go away if if FTC go FTX goes down.
Right. I mean, it's not fiat currency that's put out by a government. And, you know, the United States used to be connected to the gold standard. Now right. It's just sort of the full faith and credit of our country and our, you know, ability to pay. And a lot of other countries are that way. But cryptocurrency has no connection to a country or any sort of, you know, any other sort of hard asset that backs it up. But really, at the end of the day, if I own a piece of cryptocurrency, what you're willing to pay for it, if I were to sell it to you, is what its value is. It basically fluctuates on people's interest in it and willingness to buy it. You know, when Elon Musk went on Saturday Night Live a number of years ago and was going to, you know, promote a certain type of cryptocurrency, everybody got really excited because, right. Oh, this is going to make it, you know, explode. But what's the fundamental value in that? You don't want to put your retirement savings into something that relies on whether Elon Musk is going to say something good about it or
think?
Not. Yeah. So there's
look at him now. He's got his hands full.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's just a really risky investment. We don't call it investment. We call it a speculation, you know, because an investment involves looking at underlying fundamentals. What are the assets of the company? What's its business model? What's its cash flow? All these cryptocurrency companies, again, they're basically what somebody's willing to pay for it. There's no underlying fundamentals.
I say, if you can't explain it, don't buy it.
Yeah, exactly right.
I haven't been – it's like chess. People have tried over the years to teach me chess. It's the same thing with crypto. Anyway, I read on the website that while COVID was going on and you were doing all this wonderful modeling, you also – got the health insurers, all the health companies to cover costs of testing and treatment for COVID, which we all thank you, and directed premium relief of over $25 million back to Vermonters. What was the $25 million back to us?
Yeah, so that was important for us because when you looked at the months of March, April, and May of 2020, you know, basically all of us weren't driving anywhere. We weren't going to work. Right. We weren't going to the grocery stores regularly. We weren't going over to friends' houses. So when auto insurers looked at your risk for that year prior to knowing that COVID was going to be around, they assumed you were going to have normal driving behavior the entire year. And then all of a sudden, for 3 months, our behavior went to almost zero for many people. Some people obviously had to continue to go to work. But everybody should have seen the benefit of reduced accidents, reduced injuries, all of those things that you would assume would happen in a normal course of a day because people are out and about just weren't happening. So that $25 million was directly tied to that reduction in driving during the height of the pandemic.
Not sure I would have thought of that. Good thinking. That's great. And they obviously agreed, or maybe somebody made them pay it.
Yeah, no, exactly right. One of the first, I mean, the Vermont companies were very good about repaying, and then we wanted to make sure all the companies doing business in Vermont that were not Vermont-based followed suit. And I think we got every single company of any substance, any size, to give a refund in Vermont.
Well, it sounds fair to me.
Yeah.
That sounds great. So let's talk. We're going to have to take a break in a minute or two, but let's start talking about the treasurer's position. Why did you decide to run for treasurer?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big influences on me was Beth Pierce herself.
Right.
You know, Beth was contemplating for a couple of elections whether or not she was going to run again. Mm-hmm. You know, she could run as long as she wants to. She was very beloved.
Right.
But eventually, you know, she was having some health challenges that she's been very sort of upfront about. And she thought this was the right time for her to not run and to step aside. And she encouraged me to run, and that really was impactful on me. You know, someone that I really respect and that Vermonters really respect, encouraging you to step in their footsteps was a pretty big deal. And I had just been coming off of the COVID work, so I was a little bit tired, and you know, it wasn't necessarily it wasn't like at the top of my agenda when I was trying to think how do you unwind from 2 years of working on COVID to do an intense campaign. But the more I thought about it and I thought about how COVID changed not just Vermont but the country and the world, and I think it changed it in some ways that can really benefit Vermont. Before COVID, I was concerned about our demographics and the direction that we were heading as a state. We were getting older. Our workforce was getting smaller. Post-pandemic, not that I'm not still concerned about it, but I can see a real way to solve it. I mean, people in terms of where they live and where they work, that geographic connection has been broken. You can live and work anywhere you want. And so many people are reevaluating, you know, where do I want to live and how do I want to raise my family? And do I, you know, how do, you know, when do I want to have a family? And And so many people want to come to Vermont. We saw it through the pandemic, but we're going to continue to see it as the climate continues to get more and more challenging in other parts of the country. And people are wanting to come to New England and northern New England and Vermont in particular. We're well positioned for that over the next number of decades.
That's great.
So I really, you know, see an opportunity for our state if we can solve some of the, you know, fiscal challenges that present ourselves, making sure our pensions are strong, making sure our demographics are getting better by building more housing and providing more childcare and making it easier for young families to be in Vermont. I think we'll see a ton of economic benefit from that. So it really, for me, said this is a unique time in Vermont's history. I want to be involved in the solutions. I want to find a way where I can contribute. And that's ultimately why I decided to run.
Well, we're glad you did.
Well, thank you.
So I was going to ask you, I do all my work in Price Chopper these days because I'm retired. But I talked to this woman in line, and she had a company of 60 employees, and they did consulting work. And most of them were from out of state working for a Vermont company. Do you know through your statistics, or would it be the tax department or department, how many people here in Vermont are working for companies outside of the state of Vermont who may not be considered part of our workforce? I was wondering if that's a big chunk.
Yeah, so they're not living in Vermont, but they're working for a Vermont company?
No, the other way around.
Oh, the way around,
they're
yeah.
They're here, not in our – wouldn't be considered in our workforce, but working for somebody in California.
Yeah.
Or I wonder what number is.
There's one piece of data that I think really illuminates for us the extent to which that's happening, and it's the median income in Vermont.
Hmm.
We saw a number in 2019 that was under $65,000, the median income in Vermont. Now that number is over 70,000 for the first time in 2021. And I don't think it's all from just natural wage growth in our state. I think there's a lot of people that came with their job. Their job's based in Boston or New York or in the West Coast.
Right.
Much higher salary than the person that they were sort
yeah, right. That makes
replacing,
sense.
You know. So that really boosted our median wage, and it's going to boost our tax revenue as well. But to your point, the other challenge that it did was it had somebody come in and take a home, but they didn't necessarily add to our local workforce. So they bought a home. They probably bought it well above the last time that home sold.
Right.
And they probably bought it well above the asking price, and they probably paid cash. And
we love them.
That's all good, but it just put even more pressure on our housing market.
Right.
And for people that are trying to do jobs in Stratton and Mount Snow and Norwich and even in Burlington, it was really challenging for people to find housing near where they are working retail jobs and restaurant jobs and frontline jobs. Mm-hmm. We heard a story from a firm down in Wilmington that said they have an individual that works for them that drives from Lindenville every day. And it's just because they couldn't find housing in the Wilmington area.
Right.
So really quite astonishing. And if we want to think about how can we reduce our carbon footprint, building more dense housing, you know, in downtowns
closer
and village centers closer to home
is
a huge part of that.
You'd be surprised how many state employees in Montpelier live in Newport in the Northeast Kingdom. And that's a heck of a travel, particularly in snow.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's a good – housing's such an issue. Oh, I hear the music. That means we have to take a break. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Hi there, it's Pat McDonald back with you on Vermont Viewpoint, and joining me is Mike Pichak, the Vermont Treasurer-Elect. What a great title. Treasurer-Elect. And we're just starting to talk about what Mike hopes to do when he takes the final oath in January. Must be the first day of the
legislature. Yeah, I think it's January 4th, I think.
Is it? Well, it's early this year. Good for
you.
So you were focused during your campaign, and we're going to talk about all of these issues, pension, sustainability, housing and workforce, and financial literacy. So let's just start with pensions.
Yeah.
Big trouble, $4.5 billion at one point in unfunded liabilities. And they asked you to be on this, the legislative task force, the pension task force, which really did a lot of work.
Yeah,
seriously.
First I wondered what I did wrong to get that assignment, you know.
Well, it's not the easiest thing to understand. And what's bothering me is how many new legislators are going to be showing up January 4th. And it takes a long time. I have my background's personnel, and I was on some of the pension committees over my years in state government. And it's just hard to understand. Before we get into that, I forgot Fred from Newberry. Fred, I'm very sorry. I'm glad you're hanging on there. You have a question for Mike?
Oh, yeah. I got a question and a comment. The biggest economic disaster is for Vermont and for every state is not pensions. It's not health care. God, it's just nobody wants to talk about it, but I'll tell you what it is. How a mom and pop going to afford to pay the nursing home $10,000 a month when one of them is in the hospital? Nobody can afford it. That's over $100,000 a year. They're going to go broke in a year. They'll have no assets whatsoever. And guess what? The state is going to have to go in the real estate business, and they won't even be able to pay for it.
Now, are you talking nursing homes themselves for both mom and dad? Or are you talking
– right.
Oh, I know. I get it.
Yeah, right. My wife was in the nursing home for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And the total bill was $300,000.
Oh, write that check.
I mean, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, it's unbelievable, and nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, Mike's shaking his head yes, so – he may have a comment. Mike, you want to enter, respond to Fred?
Yeah, no, I mean, Fred, I remember I was on a couple of weeks ago, and I think Fred brought this point up, and I'm glad he brought it up again because it is a big issue. Just think about, we mentioned about COVID and how we're the second oldest state in the country.
Right.
And those demographics are still pretty similar for us, and our fastest growing age group is a really, sort of over 80 years old. So, a couple of things happen when people get older. Most of their healthcare expenses are, in those later years of life. So it puts a burden just broadly on the healthcare system in terms of the expense and on families in terms of paying for that as well. And then if you put on top of that the need for long-term care, so not just, normal visits to the hospital or normal stays at the hospital, but needing assisted living, it becomes quite unaffordable. I mean, there are federal, state and federal programs, Medicaid, that will be a backstop. But basically, you have to spend down all your assets before, you can become eligible. So it does really put families in a situation where they're not able to transfer anything down to their, their children or their grandchildren. And that can become a problem in terms of, the next generation starting up and building their own nest egg.
I think one of the reasons people work so hard is what they could leave their kids. I mean, that's sort of a natural progression of what you do. So,
And there is a long-term care insurance industry. But this industry is in real financial straits. The products were created in like the late 70s and the 80s, and they were designed for middle-income people to protect their assets and to provide them security in retirement if they needed long-term care in a nursing home. And the actuarial numbers just quite frankly were way off. People ended up living a lot longer, particularly with Alzheimer's. People could live decades with Alzheimer's, and that would be, as Fred said, $300,000 in a couple of years. So imagine that over decades.
It's pretty staggering.
Yeah, and it just became, the policies that were written, they were very beneficial early on to people that bought them, and then they wanted to have large rate increases. In Vermont, we pushed back against that for a long time, and even now we'll only have measured rate increases.
Good.
But they're still large. I mean, they're making up for decades of underpricing in these products. And now really, if you're trying to buy a new long-term care policy today, you really have to be pretty, in a pretty to be able to afford it. So there's, to Fred's point, we should be finding solutions to how are we going to make Vermonters' later years less expensive for them and their families. At-home care is certainly one of the things that's often talked
about.
Well, that's
what they're really pushing through telehealth and home care.
Yeah, and Newberry, obviously, we need to make sure that there's broadband in places like Newberry to be able to do telemedicine. Effectively.
Like a vicious circle.
Yeah.
Never stops. Anyway, back to the pension. So this group that you were involved in to look at the pension kind of put together, or your work was the basis of S-286, which the governor vetoed because he said it didn't go far enough. And but the legislature, House and Senate, passed unanimously. What's your take on S-286?
Yeah, so, you know, when we started this process, you know, it was about a 10-month process, and I was not very optimistic at the beginning because, you know, I was new to it. I wasn't involved in, you know, the process when, you know, it was originally proposed. And I know that the union representatives and the legislators had some tension about the previous year, and I just sort of observed that and tried to, you know, we all just tried to let that, you know, die down, and we tried to get to the substance of the issue.
Right.
And I just wasn't that optimistic that everybody would compromise enough to get there. But quite frankly, you know, I think we achieved the thing that was possible. I don't think anything else was possible among that group. The union representatives agreed to increase their contribution amounts. They agreed to reduce their benefits. And then on the legislative side, the legislatures agreed to put those increased contributions back into the pension system broadly and bring more one-time revenue and ongoing revenue into the system. So everybody was happy and not happy at the same time about the
because
proposal.
That was a big concession for everybody to say, we'll pay more, take less.
Hello. Yeah, for sure. And that's always the challenge. So, but it did shore it up, and particularly on the OPEB, the health insurance component of the pension system, which is a really significant underfunded part of the pension system.
Right.
You know, that's where the close to $2 billion in you know, reduction in liabilities is sort of accounted for, is in that healthcare component of the pension system.
Yeah.
But that was good to have that in a track to get paid down over the years. And I think overall it was a good compromise. And it was the thing that was possible at that moment.
But not the solution.
Well, there's still more work to do.
Right.
I mean, I think any time that we have and the legislature did include this, any time that there is surplus, you know, that some of that surplus goes to the pension and goes to the health care as well. And any time that we have one-time funds that we're wondering what to do with, I think it'd be good to put it toward the pensions. And you know, the other challenge that we're going to have on the pension side over the next decade, and again, nobody knows, nobody can predict the future and the economic future, you know, period, particularly when you're going a number of years out.
Right.
But many of the pension funds around the country are expecting that the investment returns are going to be, you know, 6.5, 6.75, even lower, some of them is their expectation. And Vermont, we still have a 7% expected return. So we're a little bit high relative to some others. And if it turns out that the stock market does have a cooler, you know, growth period over the next 5 to 10 years, then that's going to be pressure on our system.
Is there, because we were downgraded by two of the houses, correct? I'm trying to remember.
But
not by a lot, but nonetheless downgraded. And are they still looking at us? I'm hoping they're pleased with at least we took a first step.
Yeah. I mean, the things that the rating agencies always point out about Vermont were unfunded pension liability and then demographics.
Right.
Those are the two things.
And the demographics, hard to do something about that.
Yeah. But at least one of the rating agencies, they didn't put us back up into AAA, but they did change our outlook from a downgrade to a stable outlook. So they did recognize, and they tied it back to the pension deal.
Good.
So they did have at least some favorable outlook relative to the pension deal.
So I know Beth was very adamant about never changing. We have two approaches in the pension plan. You've got the defined benefit, which all state employees have, and defined contribution, which exempt employees have. Of which that was me, and which means you have, if you have defined contribution, you have a little bit more control over how your monies are invested, and there's no guarantee.
Yeah.
If you don't do well, you don't do well. The state doesn't make it up as it does in the defined benefits. But she was always adamant that state employees should not change to a defined contribution, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And I follow in her footsteps on that. I mean, if you can look at it sort of academically and think about what are the pros and the cons. And, you know, with a defined benefit plan, you know you're not going to outlive your money. I mean, that's one of the biggest pros because that's one of the biggest concerns for people as they're approaching retirement is not having enough money saved.
Right.
At least here, you know, every single month, every single, you know, pay period, you're going to get your pension check. And you don't, you know, whether you live to
no matter
105
what.
Or, you know, whatever. But, you know, and then if you think about, well, what's the potential downside of that? You know, in the same way that you don't necessarily, if all your financial means means are eaten up by health insurance and health expenses later in your life. You might not have anything to pass down to your children or your grandchildren.
Right.
So with the pension, you can have your surviving spouse on the pension, but it doesn't transfer down to, you know, another generation. Now, if you're able to – if you're fortunate enough that you have a defined contribution plan and you have been so successful that you have more than you need in retirement and you have passed away, you and your spouse, with more in that plan than you needed, then you could pass it down. But that's a fortunate few. I mean, the problem is that a lot of people can't save enough and earn enough, and they're not they're not investment experts. They don't know how to save, and they don't know how to invest, and they are really worried about that when it comes to something like
retirement. And may I just say, no matter how much money you think you have for retirement and it's enough, it isn't. Just saying. It is. It sounds great when you're retiring. Oh, I get this much money a month. Well, forget that.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't quite work out the way you planned. Living the life, what is the expression, the lifestyle you're accustomed to?
Yeah, exactly.
Good luck with that. I just have one other question,
yes.
Because we do have more work to do. I always thought that looking at new hires would be the way to go, and for some reason the legislature sort of balked at that. But if you accept a job at state government, here's the deal, and you say yes, that's the opportunity to change. I being retired, I'd have an attack if somebody changed the rules on me after I retired. I've always thought that was – it's not a contract, and it's nothing is ever solid, but it's just an unwritten
– Right.
You know, I retired on this date with these amount of benefits.
So I think – you know, I think that's right, Pat. I mean, you know, the pension's a promise is something that you heard, and I think when you're – even 7 years in, but when you're 15 years in, 20 years in, you know, you've devoted a substantial amount of your career toward getting to that pension, and then the rules change and the benefits change. You know, that's really kind of tough for people.
Yeah.
If you're coming in new and you can say your benefit structure will be this, your contribution amount will be that, and it's a higher contribution amount and a lower benefit structure to people that are already employed – you know, it's a conversation worth having, but you have to also remember it still needs to be competitive enough that you're attracting people to come to these jobs in state government. And we're having a real challenge across state government in attracting workers like every industry is having.
Well, I was thinking a lot of companies these days don't even offer a pension. They may offer some kind of investment fund sort of thing, but not a strict pension like we do.
Yeah.
And so that alone, regardless of how much, it's and a guarantee. I mean, that's good stuff.
And it is good stuff. And one of the reasons we're having such a retirement crisis in the country is because there just isn't there aren't pensions that are offered in the private sector anymore.
Right.
You know, that risk of retirement is put on the individual, not on the organizations that they worked for. And some of it's financial literacy. Some of it's providing more resources for people to be able to make retirement investing easier. Some of it is making sure they're actually putting those dollars that they earn into into those different programs to retire. But Social Security alone will not in any way get somebody through retirement.
No. People that are on TV and they say, well, I have my Social Security. I'm like, and what do you do with it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not very much.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary. Anyway, thank you for that. I know as an exempt when they change from – I think there's a lot of state employees who could manage the defined contribution plan, but I understand the resistance to it. But there's some smart folks out there who get it. I've always thought we should at least offer them the option, but I understand that I think the unions are afraid that when you go to retire, you're like, hey, wait, where's my money?
Well, right. That's always a concern, you know, that you're putting that risk on the individual. And then you also have to look at, you know, what I was talking about in terms of having a different program for new employees. I was still talking about a defined benefit plan where people are still paying into the system.
For sure.
You know, if you have fewer people paying into the system, then you can start to have some financial stress on the system as well. So I think that's the other financial concern that we often hear as
well. Yeah, I heard that as well from the union when we were having – I was pretty active in the discussion this last legislative session. So anyway, I want to just switch gears totally. I want to know about the 251 Club. You made a promise at the beginning of your campaign to go to all of the 251 towns and cities in Vermont, and 252, actually, because When did was that in June or July? City of Essex became an official city.
And we went to Essex on July 1st, as part of their celebration, to make sure that we visited that city on their first day.
Cool. So, so what did you think of our state?
Well,
towns and cities.
Yeah, it was really such a rewarding experience. First of all, we have such a beautiful state. Every part of the state is a little bit different in terms of its beauty, but every part is nonetheless beautiful, and it was amazing to be able to get out and see it. And then also about the people in Vermont. I mean, the people in Vermont are just really special. Whether they were Democrat or Republican or had heard of me or never had heard of me, they were all willing to chat and hear a little bit about what I was about. But more importantly, I was able to hear what was going on in their lives,
right,
what was going on in their communities, what the challenges were, what they were optimistic about. And when you do that 252 times over, you can see some of the threads that are similar. You can see some of the things that are very different. Essex County up in the Northeast Kingdom is very different than any other county in Vermont. Grand Isle has its own unique challenges relative to Chittenden County. Every county has some things that are similar and different. And we heard themes like housing. Housing was a constant theme. We heard issues like childcare, particularly in more of the counties that have young families. Then we heard people concerned about climate as well. I mean, those were some constant themes.
Right.
In Essex County, we mostly heard, just have Montpelier listen to us, but stay out of our business.
Right.
So
it's that independence.
Yeah. So it is interesting to hear, the perspectives that people take.
It must have taken a lot of organizing, though, 252 towns.
Yeah, it took a lot of time. I remember our first visit was to Newport, Vermont. We started in the Northeast Kingdom and we ended in the Northeast Kingdom. And that was important for us just because part of the reason for doing this was to get to places that, candidates, let alone Democratic candidates, don't get to. And I thought that was important for
us
to engage and to listen and to keep an open mind and to just, hear what was going on in their community.
Any surprises out there that people talk to you about? I don't know.
Well, I think one big – it's not surprising, but I guess it was reinforcing. Like, they were in the rural parts of our state – you heard about very different challenges than in the more urban parts of our state. Certainly broadband was always at the top of the list. Cell service was at the top of the list. But then transportation was pretty high on the list too. And both in terms of being able to get around physically, but then also, the rising cost of gas and diesel.
Right.
And that impacted agricultural industries as well. So that difference between what people, the differences in terms of what people are struggling with in our state, even though we're a small state, was definitely illuminating to me.
That's great. Well, I just love riding around. I told you my husband and I started on the 251, which apparently the club itself has met and decided to keep 251 and not do 252 because it's so well known.
So we called it the 251 plus one tour.
There you go. That's good. But there's not only a beautiful state, but there's, as you said, big differences in each area.
Yeah.
And things as a politician you have to be aware of.
Oh, absolutely.
That how different people are in certain – we're all Vermonters, but different.
Yeah, and how policies – that's right. The thing that we heard over and over again is you have a policy in Montpelier that works for Chittenden County, but it's not going to work for
Caledonia. Is that the other
County.
Vermont? Is that
yeah. So it's something that we do have to keep in mind, how are the policies and the solutions that we're coming up with – how do they play out in our communities across the state? Because they will play out differently.
Right. Back to just one more question on the pension. I think it took so much time last legislative session. I do hope they continue the discussion. But Beth had been asked over the years to divest some pension funds. And I think there was one last year from the fossil fuel companies. It was a very strong push. And she pushed back and said no because – right when you've got $4.5 billion, you don't want to take a chance of having less money in investment.
Yeah.
So, but that's something you're going to have to face.
Yeah.
Is that something we should think about or make a policy or it's all about income, revenues?
So I think, as a fiduciary, there's a VPIC, the Vermont Pension Investment Committee. So the treasurer is just one of the members on that committee. And there's a fiduciary duty that everybody on that committee has to get a good return for the pension, and that's to benefit the people getting the pension, but it's also to benefit taxpayers. It's to benefit the entire state because, at the end of the day, if we can't make good on our obligation, taxpayers are going to have to make good. So that so you have to view it from a fiduciary lens, but also you have to realize that fossil fuel companies are not going to necessarily be able to exist at all, or certainly not in the way that they're doing business today, in the future low-carbon economy that we're moving toward, not in Vermont and the country, but worldwide. You're seeing countries and organizations and people all change their behaviors to move toward a lower-carbon economy. So if you have businesses that are transitioning along with that movement, then they could very well be good investments, both in terms of financial and in terms of their environmental impact. If you have companies that are not moving along toward that future, then they could not only be bad for our environment, but they could be financially risky investments as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's from a fiduciary standpoint, that sort of angle is what I want to
That's great. Present. I think that's what Beth did too, and I was very proud of her. I thought, good for you, because it's one thing to make a statement, but another thing with the fiduciary responsibility, you can't just disregard that.
And she put that at the top of her list. She was always caring about that fiduciary responsibility.
But we wish Beth a lot of luck, and I want to thank you and wish you a lot of luck. I am having you back because I'm only on page 2 of 4 pages of questions because I want to talk about financial literacy because I've got a great idea for you. So anyway, thank you and congratulations. Thank you all for listening in. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. See? Hi there, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Back with you today, and joining me now is Bob Ney from Washington, D.C. Bob, how are you?
Hello, Pat. How are you?
Good. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Bob sent us a summary of the news, and it is pages today, so we either have to talk really fast. But I'm very glad to see that you put in a lot of information about what's happening in the Ukraine. I get a sense watching the news that we've kind of not covering it quite as much as we used to, and they're fighting every day, those people.
You know, you're right on that, Pat. I scanned the news specifically for the Ukraine, and you can't find as much right now. And, of course, that doesn't mean by any stretch of imagination it's went away. Now, Russia has pulled out in the recent story this morning.
Right.
It has pulled out under the southern Kherson region, it's called, in the Ukraine. And then Moscow says it's not a defeat, but the Ukrainians have said no. You know, they've been able to get them to retreat in that particular place. But I would note, too, and this is the saddest part of all of it, as the Russians are retreating, they're planting landmines everywhere. So they're making it basically for decades to come, potentially, a killing field for people.
Well, and weren't they about a month ago, they were right there celebrating the annexation, and they were having festivals and stuff. And so why do, without any embarrassing Putin, but why are they pulling out? It's just not working, right? They're just getting resistance.
It's not working. And also areas that they're taking over, the Ukrainians are fighting them. You know, they've had these scam elections where they say, you know, the people voted to become part of Russia, and that's just not true. But they're getting a lot of resistance, and I must say, I don't know how the Ukrainians are doing it. You know, they've had one-third of the energy cut off from the country, water resources, you know, provide fresh water bombed, hospitals, you know, schools, et cetera, but they still continue to hold pretty firm.
They are an amazing people. They really are, and that's why I'm a lot sad that we haven't kept them in our forefront, because we really need to, especially today on Veterans Day. I mean, these people have sacrificed everything for their country, so that they could remain free. And
they sure have.
Yeah, and here we are not paying attention. But I sincerely hope we keep the pressure on of helping them, and maybe the president's trip. He just left last night, did he not?
Yes, he's off to the climate talks. He has a couple purposes. He's going to Egypt, and then after that for specifically climate talks with you know, some foreign nations. Then he goes to what's called the G20, mm-hmm. which are 20 countries that are aligned. And that'll be very narrowed, I guess you could say. There'll be climate issues, but they'll talk about, you know, other issues, mainly affecting financial and global markets, although President Biden and Xi, the premier of China, will be face-to-face. And
right.
we know that President Biden will bring up the issue of Taiwan.
Yes, for sure, because Xi keeps pushing that, doesn't he?
Sure does. It's a strong point with Xi and something very forceful with him.
Right. Do you think there will be discussion about Ukraine there? I would hope so, just to keep the pressure on.
Well, it'll be there. In fact, it's going to be discussed.
Oh, good.
If not formally also, but informally, to the point where Putin is not attending. Putin has backed out of the G20.
Oh, I didn't hear. I knew the president wasn't going to meet with him, but he's not going at all?
He's not going. So, therefore, obviously, Putin simply wants to probably avoid face-to-face confrontation with Biden in particular, but also with the West.
Right.
It's kind of amazing that Putin is a little bit afraid. Yeah, he's not going to attend the G20 in Bali in person.
Good. Sorry, but good. Anyway, so just looking through some of your notes, we're all talking about inflation these days, and it doesn't look like it's going to get much better anytime soon, eh?
Right. We're fresh off the election, and, of course, inflation was part of the election. There were a lot of issues, Roe v. Wade,
right.
Trump, and, you know, inflation, et cetera. We can go down the list, but inflation was out there at the top, and it looks like from what's been reported, there's a little sign of relief in the October inflation yep. data. And I know when people talk about 10%, I also do some house flipping, and let me tell you, most of the products I buy are a lot more than 10% in the increase. So it's going to be out there. The Fed has been raising interest rates, trying to cope with it. And the downside to that, of course, too, is that they raise so high and the house demand pulls back. And then you have a lot of people trapped in rent that is also escalating. So it's a real problem. So inflation is definitely still out there.
You should come to Vermont. We have got such an old stock of houses that need to be flipped.
I love your state.
It's
beautiful.
We're really struggling with housing and the shortages, and it's hard to attract new employees coming in from out of state because they can't find the house. So if you come and flip a few, that'd be cool.
It would be fun in Vermont. I would love that. I like old houses. My wife and I, our first house was an 1885 French Empire.
Oh, stop. That sounds great.
A little town, called Barnesville, Ohio. And so I'm just, I like the old houses.
That's great. So I don't know if there's a specific log here, but the cost, as you mentioned, of fuel and the food. We're just eating differently in our house these days and worried about the upcoming winter and what choices people are going to have to make.
Well, it's tough. And especially, for example, if people, are large meat eaters, that's where it's all risen, you know, dramatically too. Yeah. But just trying to buy any type of food, there are increased costs in those food period. I mean, I today, like a lot of people in the country, you know, I'm looking at coupons and price shopping
exactly.
more than I've ever done in my lifetime.
Yeah, I'm not a coupon person, but I am now. Because you have to.
Trying.
You're foolish if you leave it on the table. So,
right.
Anyway, exactly. Just going through your notes, what's your response to the U.S. judge in Texas striking down Biden's student loan plan, which must have been a big loss for the administration?
Right. It's coming from two different directions now. You've got the Texas judge striking it down. You have a case by six states was put into a St. Louis court. So it's coming from two ends. This one, I believe the writing's on the wall. It's going to keep going with the appeals court. And I think this one goes, well, I know it will. It'll go straight up to the Supreme Court to decide. Now, the issue here is not should it be done or not. The courts are looking at how it was done. It was done by executive order. And by the way, I wanted to give you, for your listeners, a little hint or a tip on something that's not going to be talked about anywhere in the United States today on radio except your show, and that's signing statements. If they want to Google presidential signing statements, No, this is the best kept secret in D.C. You have executive orders. The president says, oh, we're going to forgive student loans. Then you got signing statements where they pass the law, but he puts little notes, and they kind of have a lot of power if it goes to court of what the president thinks about that law.
Really?
So, oh, yes. And again, well, if you Google presidential signing statements, you're going to say, I didn't know that.
I'm going to do that.
Nobody talks about it. So it's about the power of the executive with executive orders and signing statements.
Wow, I'm a researcher at heart. That's why I like doing this show. Yeah. It's the research part that I enjoy. Right. But anyway, interesting. To close out the show, Bob, you want to talk about the control of Congress, and it's still up in the air today. Was it Arizona, Georgia, Nevada? We could have a discussion about why it's taking them so long, but it's a big issue.
Well, it is. When I entered Congress, I was part of the class, the Contract with America class, and we made Gingrich the Speaker. It was pretty well decided. We showed up. There we all were. It was all decided before a Tuesday, the next Tuesday. Now it's not the case. I mean, we don't know the numbers today. Of course, the Senate is going to have a runoff in Georgia, so that determines 50-50 Democrat or 51-49 Republican on December the 6th. But the House is just, the margins are so close in so many races. Republicans are ahead, and yes, they're probably going to take the House, but it's going to be very, very close. So opening day in the House is going to be something to watch, because the Speaker's going to be up for election as Speaker, and it's going to be a tight one.
Well, and I think one of the reasons they said was that even though people got ballots at home, they brought them in on election day, because I like to go in on election day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really messed them up. I don't think they were planning on so many ballots being hand delivered on the same day, right?
I think so. And then some of these boards in the states, the state doesn't allow them to be counted beforehand.
Right.
Some of them they do. And of course, then Arizona had some kind of mechanical problem, failure in their system. And each and every state might be different, and it's just adding up to, we're not going to get the election on the results like we normally do on the same day. There's just too many close races.
A few changes coming, I would think. Bob, thank you very much for this excellent out, and thank you for talking about the Ukraine. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you shared that with our listeners.
You too, Pat.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you next week. This is Pat McDonald from Vermont Viewpoint. Hi there, we're back. This is Pat McDonald with Vermont Viewpoint, and joining me for the next 15 minutes is Kevin McCallum, who's written an article for 7 Days that we need to talk about today. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, Pat. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. This is great. So Kevin's article is entitled, Vermonters Look for Cheaper Ways to Keep Their Homes Warm This Winter. Kevin, it was not an uplifting article.
No, nor was some of the stuff you were just talking about Ukraine, and this is sort of directly related to that same issue.
Well, that's part of what we're dealing with the oil crisis, is it not, fuel?
That's right. So, I mean, a lot of people, I think, fully understand that Europe is really in an energy pinch because of the war in Ukraine. But what I was surprised to find out was that the energy costs in the United States are skyrocketing because of the war in Ukraine as well, because we're in a global market, and North America is a very large producer of fossil fuels. And so a lot of the diesel fuel and liquefied natural gas that is produced here in the United States is actually getting on ships, being put on ships and sent to Europe. And so that's changing the structure
balance
of the markets, and it's increasing prices for Vermonters. Anyone who has a furnace that burns fuel oil is going to be paying 44% more this year, and anyone who heats with kerosene is going to be paying 56% more this year, and that's a lot. That could be $900 to $1,200 more per month for those folks. So that's a real problem for people.
Yeah, and you were talking in your article about people are just really scrambling to figure out what's the best alternative for them. In my house, we have both heat and we burn fuel oil and wood. And I'm thinking this year we're going to be doing more of the latter than the former. But it's even hard to find wood. If you haven't already done it, it's a little hard to find the cordwood out there.
That's right. Yeah, most people who burn wood in the winter, obviously in Vermont, are not going to start looking for that wood in
right.
November. And so luckily people have probably done a decent amount of the work they need to do to get that cordwood stacked and dried
yep.
and ready to roll. But you're right. The cordwood dealers in the state are talking about dramatic increases in people trying to increase their stock of cordwood because they'd much rather burn cordwood this winter than fuel oil that's going to be 50% more expensive.
Yeah, and I love that there. When we bought our house back in 1990, it was electric, and I think Bruce had it changed within a week. Because
yeah,
back then it was like, what are you crazy? So you switched yeah. to oil back there, but now people are thinking it's actually cheaper maybe to go to electric, which is.
Well, that's because the type of electric you're talking about is very, very different, right? The electric resistance baseboard heating that
yep.
was installed in a lot of homes in Vermont is very inefficient.
Ah.
So, yeah, so people switch to other types of fuels like fuel oil and natural gas, and now a lot of people are deciding to switch back to
right.
electric heat.
Interesting,
because heat pumps are very efficient, it's a totally different technology.
Yep,
it's the same technology that runs your refrigerator. It just runs in reverse.
It
heats your home with electricity and Freon, and it draws that heat out of the outside air condenses it and pumps it into your house.
Yep. I learned about that. We camp in Maine in the summer, and we have an RV, and the guy across the street from us put in one of those systems, and it's very small, and it's not cheap putting in, but then he was showing us what the return is going to be financially, and I was very impressed. It's a good way to go because even though you spend some money up front, in the long run, it'll really do you well. So that's great. And I asked somebody yesterday on the show about kerosene because that seems to be a place where people are turning to these days. And when I was growing up, kerosene and electric heaters were considered pretty dangerous. But he assured me that today it's very safe and not inexpensive. Nothing's inexpensive, but cheaper to use kerosene, which I was surprised to hear and glad to hear.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. So
I would at least
on the increase in the prices, kerosene is one of the most dramatically increased fuels year over year. So it may have been the case before, but I think given all this pressure. It's probably not the case anymore.
Huh. See, I'm glad I asked that question because it's all about cost, isn't it? So then summarizing your article, what do you think people are going to be doing this season? I mean, what is the decisions that they're making?
So what I found was people are making three decisions, essentially. They're increasing the number of options that they have for lower priced fuels, right? Like we talked about.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
for cordwood, they would use more of that. There's also people who are looking for financial assistance, right? So if you know that that's going to be a difficult cost for you to bear this winter, you're starting to make some inquiries about whether you might qualify for some of the many financial assistance
mm-hmm.
programs that Vermont has. There was, I think, almost $6 million additional dollars put into one of the state's key heating programs
Great.
This winter in order to make sure that those grants to people could cover the higher cost. And the other thing people are doing, I think, is they're weatherizing their homes. They know, one thing you can do if you don't want to replace the furnace in your basement or spend thousands and thousands of dollars of on these electric heat
mm-hmm.
pumps to install in your house. There's low tech options, right? There are ways to weatherize your homes, your home in many different ways, whether it's, caulking windows and doors and foam insulation in your basement and wrapping pipes. So there's a lot a lot more interest in that as well among consumers.
Yeah, I wasn't sold on, I know, don't yell at me here, but I wasn't sold on weatherization for a long time. But recently, the articles I've been reading and talking to people who have gone through that process, and there are so many nonprofit organizations that offer assistance with weatherization, I'm sold. That makes sense to me, especially with our older stock here, a housing stock in Vermont. You know, they need some tidying up and some filling in the cracks a little bit. So that's a good thing. And I think in Vermont, there's also the decision about carbon emissions, about how to balance that, because Vermonters are very much aware of carbon emissions and climate change and all of that. So all of these decisions, I'm sure, in their mind are weighed against what it does to the environment.
That's right. I mean, the what they call the thermal sector in Vermont, emissions from the thermal sector, the thermal heating sector, I think account for a third of all of the carbon emissions in the state of Vermont. Second
really?
Only to transportation.
Right.
So it's a huge amount of the carbon emissions in the state. And so people who are looking at their own households, their own lives, trying to figure out how they can reduce their carbon footprint are looking at a variety of things. And the number one thing seems to be a lot of people who have older gas vehicles are looking to get hybrid vehicles
right.
or electric vehicles. And then the other thing is they're looking at ways that they can maybe reduce the carbon emissions from their homes.
Yep, that's great. Could you talk a little bit before we end the show about pellet stoves and the use of pellets? I remember when they first came out, there was such a shortage of pellets that it was a real concern. I'm assuming, since it's in your article and elsewhere, that that's not an issue anymore, that they are available and work.
Well, you know, I'm not totally sure about that. My article spoke to the owner of one of the largest wood stove retailers in the state called Chimney Sweep Fireplace Shop.
Oh, yes, of course.
There's one in Shelburne and one in Berlin.
Right down the street from where I live. Good store.
That's right. The owner of that shop told me that after 47 years in business, he is on track to have the single largest year in
wow.
the company's history. So there's clearly an interest
yep.
in not only people who already burn wood, but people switching to burning wood and pellet stoves. And so I'm not really informed about whether there is a sufficient amount of,
yep.
of pellets. I know that people like to make sure that the pellets that they burn in the state of Vermont are from the area. I mean, ideally, when you are burning wood and burning pellets, the ideal situation is that that resource is from somewhere around where you live,
right.
whether, you know, 20 miles, 50 miles, 100 miles. And so when there are shortages locally, what happens is the market tends to reach out past Vermont's borders to New Hampshire, to New York,
right,
to Canada.
Right.
And what you'll see is these big pallets of these pellets from Quebec, essentially. That's, I think, the number one place where they come in. So what I often find when I talk to people who own pellet stoves is that they're very efficient. They're very low maintenance. It's much easier than stacking cordwood and drying cordwood and throwing cordwood in the stove. But there is a concern among people about whether there's a sufficient amount locally. And I know that in many cases, some people do have to go out of the state and out of
really?
The country to get pellets.
Yeah, because I remember I was 10, 15 years ago, it was bad. I mean, people just couldn't. This is what they were relying on for heat, and there was such a shortage. So I'm assuming some enterprising person is figuring this out and we'll have enough supply because – and I must say the state of Vermont has got so many resources for help. And I understand I think our congressional delegation just announced this morning that there's a huge influx of money coming for Vermont for heating this winter. So – anyway, thank you, Kevin McCallum, for giving us all this exciting news. Maybe next time we'll talk something a little more on the upbeat side, Kevin. But it's good
Sounds
information
exciting.
For sure. Thank you very much. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Hi there, this is Pat McDonald back with Vermont Viewpoint, and joining me for this rest of the show for the next half hour is Maura O'Brien, who is a nurse and is a supervisor for the State Employee Wellness Program and a friend. So hi, Maura, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Thank you. You know, I was citing it's flu season, and I'm a retired state employee, so I usually get the letter that says, hey, we've got flu clinic going on. I thought I should have Maura in to talk about all the work she does and her program and how well received it is. So first of all, Maura, can you talk a little bit about your background and how you came to be the head of the Vermont Wellness Program?
So as you mentioned, I'm a registered nurse, and I have worked in a lot of different areas of nursing, including hospital, colleges, corporate, and ended up in New York working for a subdivision of the Visiting Nurse Service of New York. And that's how I kind of got into a management level of working in wellness and corporate right. wellness. And yep. so then when I decided to relocate to Vermont, this job opportunity right. came open, and I interviewed, and they offered me the job, and I moved up here in 2005 and took the job, and I've been up here ever since.
Well, we're glad you're here. That's
Thank
great.
You.
And this program is called, which is a sort of new for me, it's Live Well Vermont,
yes.
which is a great tagline.
Thank
that's
you.
Great. That happened under your watch?
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. And it's obviously, as I said before, didn't you have something to do with New York's flu program?
I did. I actually, the company I worked for is a subdivision of the Visiting Nurse Service of New York, who runs the flu program for New York City.
Great.
So I provided all of the staffing, all of the nurses that staffed these clinics, and we had 7 programs running simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
And we vaccinated about 85,000 people
Maura.
In 4 weeks.
Oh, my God.
So when they told me that I would be vaccinating about 5,000 people, I thought, well, that's a piece of cake.
Well, we are lucky to have you. That's great. That's a lot of people.
It is a lot. And they do simultaneous flu clinics at the congregate care where, you know, elderly people are right. living. And we did corporate and did just open clinics where hundreds and hundreds of people would come and line up and get vaccinated.
That's great. Well, so here you are doing our flu clinic.
Yes.
So thank you very much. And you provide shots for active, temporary, and retired state employees, which is me.
Yes.
And it looks very comprehensive. How do you even – is it – you go visit the same sites every year, I would think, hopefully, make it a little easier?
Well, we try to make sure that we cover the state.
Right.
So we basically get conference rooms booked at – most of the main state buildings all across the state, so from Newport to Bennington, Brattleboro,
right.
Springfield, Rutland, St. Albans, obviously Burlington and Montpelier,
right.
Williston and Essex. So we do that, and we also do the AOT, the Agency of Transportation, we do their garage sites.
Oh, nice.
At each of the districts. So
are you able to do this with your staff, or do you have to bring in nurses from elsewhere?
So we actually currently have a contract with Kinney Drug.
Oh, of course.
And so the pharmacists are doing it, and this is our fourth year working with Kinney, and
nice.
They've been fantastic to work with. So they provide the vaccine and all of the supplies, and the vaccinators who are all pharmacists. And so oftentimes they're seeing their own customers when they come in.
I was going to say, Steve from Kinney Drugs said, yes. You tell me you knew him. And I said, do you know more O'Brien?
Yes.
So there you go. I have to go get a shot and get Steve to give me a shot. So it's sort of like New York in a smaller version, right?
Smaller version.
So your wellness program when I was commissioner of personnel was nothing like it is now. It has grown tremendously. And let's go through some of the things that you do, because wellness itself is such a big thing these days.
Yes.
And I'm very supportive of it in corporations. And it just makes sense if you take care of your own body.
Absolutely.
That you'll feel better.
Yes.
You know, and even doctors now they call it treating the whole person.
The holistic.
Yeah.
Yes.
That it really makes a difference.
Absolutely.
You know, it's great. And I think I wasn't too sold on it when it first came out. And I think a lot of people must have felt like I did, like, what is this?
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah. The healthier your workforce, the better your company, the more productive they are. If people are not either calling out sick or coming to work sick, if they're feeling well and healthy and connected, they're going to be more productive. Mm-hmm. Your morale is going to be better. You're going to have less injuries at the work site. So there's nothing negative about having a wellness program and really supporting a healthy, well culture at your work site.
And it can be fun.
Because
you've got a lot of programs which are kind of fun. So we'll talk about them. You do on-site wellness screenings. You do screenings for employees. How does that work? And what do you do?
So, and when I came to the state, that's basically all they did.
Right, exactly.
And it was nurses at that point that did it. And we go out to work sites and we meet with individual employees and retirees. We do their a finger stick.
Mm-hmm.
Where we check their cholesterol, their total cholesterol, their good cholesterol, get a little bit of a sense of their bad cholesterol. And we also check their blood sugar and their blood pressure.
Nice.
And then we, you know, have a conversation with them about the results and what changes they might want to make or adjust in their lifestyle and how things are going. And then we also take that opportunity to talk about the program. Do they know about the incentive program? Are they taking advantage of it? Are there any questions that we can answer? Our clients are the state employees and retirees, and we're really here to support them.
That's great.
And so we want to educate them on the program and the services available and make sure that they're aware of them.
Well, you mentioned that magic word, incentives, and there's some ways to make a little cash in the pocket.
There is.
Yeah. Why don't you explain all that?
So we started the incentive program, I want to say – I have to think. It's been probably 2015, I think, we started it. So we have a portal through our partnership with Blue Cross Blue Shield Vermont, and we primarily run our incentive program through that, where people have the option to do activities from a menu, a very wide scope menu. And they can earn points that turn into money if they have insurance with the state. And we actually want people who don't have insurance with the state to participate as well. And we do prize drawings for them.
Cool.
So we try to support everyone. And this year, so the calendar year runs January 1st to December 1st. And people could earn up to $300.
Wow.
So it's $60 per quarter. And then they get an additional $60 if they complete just an online health assessment, which takes just about 10 minutes to do.
I like the name that you gave this, Progress Over Perfection.
Yes.
That's me.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's everybody.
Yeah, it is, because, you know, perfection's a pretty hard thing to attain.
Well, and a lot of people feel like if they can't do it all, why bother?
Right.
You know, rather than knowing that taking small steps – can lead to big changes.
That's great. We were just talking about what she and her staff do for on-site wellness screenings, wellness incentives, where you can get actual $300.
Yes.
Right?
So we're in our last quarter, which ends December 1st. So people have just a couple of weeks.
To kill themselves.
You know, one of the things we've tried to do with the staff, and I have two amazing wellness specialists who work with me, one who's a registered dietitian and the other one who's a physical fitness expert. So we have a really beautiful balance in my tiny little staff. One of the things that we tried to do was to make the menu of activities really broad. So a lot of the things people were already doing, and it might be things like supporting your emotional health by reading a newspaper or doing a puzzle, going to your doctor or your dentist or getting your flu shot or your COVID booster.
Right.
That's one thing I wanted to let you know was that we gave COVID boosters in addition to flu shots.
Oh, did you?
Year.
Oh, great.
So we did a double dip, and it was really heartening to see how many employees and retirees took advantage of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So you give out the COVID boosters?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Oh,
we did.
Okay.
The new Pfizer bivalent booster. So we just had our last clinic yesterday.
Great.
And so we're done for the season. But certainly, you know, people that have insurance through the state can go really anywhere now and get a flu shot. You can get it at the supermarket.
See Steve at Kinney's.
You can get it at Kinney's. You can get it at your own pharmacy.
Right.
You go to a different pharmacy and certainly your doctor's office.
That's great. Yeah, that's an important point when you mentioned the doctor, that what you do, you let employees know it does not replace going to your doctor. These are folks who are there to help you and maybe to guide you to a doctor with some, you know, early warning signals that maybe you should go see somebody, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's a really nice opportunity. It gives people a snapshot of what might be going on with them.
Right.
But we're not a clinical program. We basically focus on lifestyle changes.
Right.
And but because we have background in health.
Right.
You know, we know what those numbers mean, and so we can educate the employer or retiree on what those numbers mean and whether they should be following up with their doctor.
Some of those things that you mentioned before, you don't know you're having a problem, like high blood pressure.
Like high blood pressure.
Until it's maybe too late. So it's good to get an early warning.
Right.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I noticed you also do coaching, and it's a whole process of 10 sessions, and you do it telephonically. I was going to ask you if you do the telemedicine approach these days, but I think people are getting used to talking to their healthcare providers by the telephone.
Yeah, and actually a lot of it we do on Teams, which is like Zoom.
Right, Zoom.
Yeah, and we can do it on Zoom if it's a retiree. So it's great because you get that one-on-one face-to-face.
For sure.
Which we were doing telephonically before, but it's even more special and close.
Well,
now.
And you know what I like about it? Because the doctor, not that they don't, they really have to look at you. And when you're in their office, sometimes they're kind of looking at the computer.
Yes.
Telemedicine, they have to look at you.
And they do.
I like that.
Yes. They pay attention.
Yes. It's like, hello, I'm here. Anyway, you talk to people about using skills and strategies of how to get better, but also you talk about having them define what wellness is to them, which I think is an important thing.
Yeah, it's very different. Wellness coaching is very different from working with a registered dietitian or a physical fitness expert who gives you a plan that you follow. So they give you the answer and you follow it oftentimes. With wellness coaching, what we do is facilitate the conversation where you define your own vision of your health and wellness. And then out of that vision of like where you want to see yourself in an ideal world of health and wellness, you develop a goal, which is about 5 or 6 months out of like what you'd like to be doing on a regular basis or what you'd like to have changed by that period of time. And we make it a SMART goal, and SMART is an acronym for specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-based.
Love it.
So we say, you know, November 11th, so in May 11th, what do you want to be doing differently? What do you want to have achieved? And then out of that goal, we set 1 or 2 week goals and say, okay, so what's the first step to get there?
Great.
And
they must have ownership in this because it's their plan.
I think so much more
Yep. Then you handed me a here, do this.
And a lot of times people, I think, through the vision, through the development of that vision, sometimes they come into it thinking, I want to lose weight or I want to exercise more. And then they discover through the process that they might be really stressed out and they need to deal with sort of emotional support.
Right.
And that's causing them to eat or not exercise. And so they think, I have to exercise more. But when it's really stress management that they need to work on, and then that sort of opens the door for them to make changes in other areas. That's so great.
And they discovered it too.
They discover it. Yeah.
I love it. It's the buy-in, I bet. So you also do a lot of workshops and presentations and retreats. I like that idea.
Yeah, a lot of divisions, and particularly with COVID, people are doing a lot of things outside and doing a lot of things to support their work environment. And so we will actually go to their retreat and do a physical fitness routine or run a meditation for them.
Oh, nice.
Talk about nutrition. So pretty much, you know, we have kind of a menu of ones that we do, but mostly we customize them depending on the conversation we have with the contact person at the site.
That's great.
You know, what are you looking for? How can we support you? And then we'll go down and do anywhere from an hour to half hour to half day to full day. Whatever you need, we can provide it.
That's great. And do a lot of the departments take you up on that? I mean, are they aware enough to know that service is available?
I think that that's always a continual process.
Right.
We do have an ambassador program, so we have volunteers at work sites, and we have about 200 ambassadors who are located at the work sites
great.
Are just passionate about wellness, and so are eyes and ears at the work site, and so they're really great in educating their supervisors and managers about opportunities that are available.
How do you keep them in the loop about what's going on in your department? Do you meet with them or email them or keep in touch that way?
Yeah, we do quarterly webinars with them to just kind of give them a heads up, and we all actually do a monthly newsletter.
Nice.
We developed the newsletter for the department, so our little group does that, but we send an ambassador newsletter a few days before and have it focused primarily on wellness activities to give them a heads up about the new corporate challenge that's starting or the flu program that's running.
That's great. Because I read about the program, you can do it just maybe putting out the newsletter, that's the low end, and all the way to, you know, meeting individually with people. So it's anything you as an ambassador want to make it.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
there's no expectations other than awareness.
Absolutely, which is huge.
Yeah.
And we find that work sites that have ambassadors, there's a lot more participation in those work sites.
That's great. And does the AOT garage folks, are they part of this process too?
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah, the garages have some fantastic people that are
awesome,
that take care of their guys.
Well,
we need
them healthy because the winter's coming on, and they'll be that. Speaking of stress, I don't know how those guys do what they do.
Yeah.
And women,
We have women too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you also have an events calendar, which
we
do keep up. And anything funky coming up that we should know about or state employees should know about?
Well, CAPS, which is the training division at the state, November is actually focused on wellness. And so we're actually doing a lot of classes through them. So we just did a webinar yesterday calling Making Your Way to Wellness. And next week we're doing a 15-minute online team session. Each day a different focus, meditation, physical activity, emotional support, nutritious snacks.
Nice.
To just get on so people can join it. We're in our last corporate challenge, which is focused on finance, focusing on finance.
Excellent.
Because that's environment.
That could be stressful.
Environment and finance was our last focus for this fourth quarter, and so we're doing that and kind of gearing up for 2023.
That's great.
So we're in the planning phase for it.
As folks know, finance in couples and just finance yourself can be very stressful if it's not going the way you had envisioned.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what do you talk about in the finance? I mean, how do you teach people to sort of maybe stop spending, to get a handle on where they are financially?
Well, we have a lot of courses available, workshops available that teach people about spending and debt, budgeting, saving for retirement, saving for an expense such as a car or a house.
Great.
So there's different workshops. We also do a lot of referrals. We work very closely with Empower, which is our retirement, the company that services the state with retirement services. They do workshops once a month, so we educate people about that.
Excellent. We've got to go. I'm very sorry, Maura. You guys are doing such a great job. Thank you to you and your staff for keeping all our state employees and retirees healthy. This is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Thank you.
Thank you.